Okay. We'll call the meeting to order, and we're trying to, the Department of Finance is finishing up their presentation on maps, and we're going to have a presentation and discussion of the lease purchasing finance map. So, I don't know who's up here talking about it, but whoever is. Okay, and Representative Mason moves adoption of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are adopted. Thank you. Okay. Okay, Ms. Amber.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. Thanks for having us back again. To remind you, Stephanie Andrews, Deputy Commissioner for Finance, through the Minnesota Management and Budget. We are returning to finish the presentation that we started on the 26th. If you remember, we left off discussing the benefits of moving the current system to a better e-procurement environment, and Ms. Lowe is going to walk through some of the more specific benefits of the new accounting system.
Ms. Lowe.
Madam Chair, members, thank you. My name is Lori Moe, Minnesota Management and Budget. If you have the slides from our last visit, I'll be starting on slide 9 to talk about the system benefits. One of the things you heard us discuss previously was the technology risk we face with the current system. Our replacement system will address
for,
all of...
For members, that's on page 5.
Okay.
Of the...
Okay. Excuse me. Yeah, you.
That's okay.
It will allow us to address those issues and reap the benefits of current technologies, including web capability and modern databases, and provide more cost-effective solutions, better access, and improved security. All of this will enable us to implement better business processes. For example, more robust security will allow us to manage user access down to a lower level of detail. This will avoid the problem that we currently have where employees are sometimes granted more access than they need to do their jobs because of systems limitations. For example, an employee might only need field purchase order authority for emergency procurements, but instead gets much broader procurement access. The newer systems also provide a better audit trail. In some of our transactions today, our current system only captures the last date and personal identifier of the last person to touch a specific item. The newer systems will retain all the history of those transactions as well. One important control that we have in place currently is a requirement for agencies to get their executive budget officer approval for high-risk transfer transactions. And while our current system has an approval field, it is not capable of applying a hard edit to require the approval in advance of the actual transfer. The new system will also provide more detail and better tools, resulting in improved reporting capabilities and improved data for decision making. On the next slide, there are a number of areas where we will enjoy greater efficiency as a result of the new system. We've examined our current business processes and envisioned new, more efficient, streamlined approach to many of them. As part of the implementation, I talked about this a little bit last week, we'll incorporate the best practices embedded in the delivered software and make additional improvements in how the state does business, and at the same time working with an minimally modified version of the software to make future upgrades more efficient. A new user interface will improve accuracy and efficiency. If you look at the next slide after this one, you'll see a screenshot of our current system, and you'll see a random error that occasionally pops up in our current system. The users today, when this happens, have to reboot their machine, spend time waiting for it to restart, and then spend some additional time researching whether the transaction that was in progress actually was completed prior to the error or if it needs to be repeated. Also, you can see the many different fields on a single entry screen in the accounting system. And what we don't have that most of us consider routine in our desktop applications today We don't have online help. We don't have drop-down boxes. We don't have autofill capability for frequently used codes, etc. So the person doing the data entry spends time looking up those codes, doing them from memory. The new system will make that more efficient and more accurate. The workflow functionality in the new system will improve efficiency and strengthen our controls by adding the ability to pass transactions electronically for approvals. For example, transactions that are now reviewed manually before entry could be reviewed online after their initial data entry. This will reduce errors by eliminating the situation where the original transaction was approved correctly, but then because of a data entry error, it's not passed into the system at the intended amount. In purchasing transactions, a single request could flow from the requester to the approval to the buyer without the production or routing of any paper documents. And keep in mind that in an enterprise of our size, there's over 400,000 of that type of transaction that occurs every year. Customer self-service functionality will also streamline processes. For example, vendors will be able to update payment, address, and other information online, as well as retrieve information regarding their payment history. There are over 50,000 new vendors added to our vendor file every year, and more than 20,000 updates. And finally, a web-based product will significantly reduce workload in the IT maintenance across state government. Currently, agencies are required to maintain the client software on the desktop of 2,500 users. The new system will use standard web browser and not have any custom software on the user's desktop. Also, additional functionality will eliminate agency workarounds and the need for separate additional software. For example, improved inventory tracking capacity will avoid an investment at DOT for a separate system. And then finally, on our last slide, I want to comment on the current status of our work. As you know, we've been planning for this project for a couple of years, and with the help of some planning funding that you provided for us last year, we have continued to make progress since we were talking about this project a year ago. We have brought together 130 agency subject matter experts to look at business processes and to develop over 2,000 business and technical requirements. We've had work groups on enterprise reporting and chart of account issues. We've developed our procurement strategy, drafted and published our RFP. We, in January, held a vendor conference and have recently responded to a question period where we answered vendor inquiries. And we are expecting proposals from the vendors on March 16th and have a schedule laid out for evaluation and selection during the spring period, and we'll be prepared to enter contract negotiations following session. That'll take questions.
Okay.
Representative, you don't have a question. Okay. Representative Smith.
Okay, turns.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple questions for you, and then one comment. One of them is savings. You know, I hear throughout the thread of this that it appears as though you're expecting some anticipated savings. When you have done the rest of your budgeting, have you factored in those savings into some of your budget proposals as well?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, the governor's budget does not include savings. The business case does discuss some savings. Remember, this is a two-year project, and so some of the savings that we would anticipating would be beyond the biennium that we're talking about now. The other challenge that we have, that you will have as we look at savings, is the fact that as we talk about efficiencies in this system, it's bits and pieces of people in many different functions. They end up being able to do their job more efficiently, more effectively, with greater security. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's easy to capture those bits and pieces. The governor hasn't included those savings in his budget recommendation.
Okay, appreciate that. Then one other question that it seems as though, from what you've given the presentation here, that it looks like you've built in, you know, we've heard from the legislative office of the legislative auditor and others as well, some of the auditing issues and the checks and the balances and processing receipts. I mean, this is very, very heavy in that area, plus all the interfacing with all the agencies as well. I'd like to have a little bit more, some documentation or something that demonstrates, either perhaps otherwise, that those auditing and those checks, that's one of those savings things, that an embarrassing thing that you can really be in this system. Can you just give us more information about that piece of what you've been doing? Because now is the time to address those issues.
Ms. Amber, Ms. Mo, who else?
Madam Chair, Representative Kiffmeyer, let me start. Ms. Mo may have some more specifics to add in here. I think that when you heard from Auditor Noble, you heard his answer, which we agree with, that a system can't fix all of those things. So it's a balanced approach. It's the system, certainly in a new system, there are a number of places where the system doesn't provide either the easy capacity or even any capacity to put edits in place or to put controls in place that would prohibit certain actions from taking place. It also, if you look, for example, at segregation of duties, something that the auditor has also talked about in recent OLA reports, there are some places where in order to provide access for an individual to do a certain activity, they need to get access to a whole suite of activities, some of which then create some trouble in terms of segregation of duties and what they're able to do. And so a new system would solve some of those things automatically simply by, again, having capacity far updated from when the system was first implemented. There's also that other side of things, though, that a new system will also give us the chance to continue the work with the subject matter folks in the agencies and the accounting and financial staff we've been working with for several years on this project, to step back and say, so let's talk about how we're doing something. How do we streamline it? How do we use, whether it's lean or other ways to evaluate our processes, how do we make that better, make it easier, and make it more secure from an internal control perspective, from an IT security perspective, all of those things. I think that's what the opportunity of a new system gives you, and we're certainly interested and eager to take advantage of everything that we can.
Madam Chair, just follow up to that. In permissions, you know, in this process, this is one of the most tremendous opportunities you have here, that you can fine-tune these permissions to a tremendous degree in a way and you can hold people accountable to the enhancing the following through that in a way that is extremely difficult sometimes to do on paper and those old COBOL language mainframes just didn't allow for that. So I want to say, though, I know and I've used them before, designed them, worked with them, and we use them greatly, and not to any degree like you have, but I know they're there, and that was a few years ago, and I'm sure those systems are there still today. But to whatever degree, fully you can, or creating ports and future opportunities, placeholders, or whatever it is, to make sure you have that, because it will save tremendously, not necessarily in the bits and pieces, but those bits and pieces accumulate, and especially in the auditing part. So that's it, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Woodbrook.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to return, I guess, both what you just said, Representative Kiffmeyer, and what Representative Kahn has said before, which is you have your advocates for MAP in this room, in the House. Probably not very many people outside of this committee know or care or would be supportive of spending a big amount of money on this system. And I personally think it's important that we do it and that we do it right. More importantly, that we take it and maximize the opportunity. And so, to me, you may have this, but it would be easier if there was a very strong ROI type document, both in hard dollars, return on investment, and in soft, the soft ROI piece, the improved service, the improved effectiveness, the improved control type thing. And I don't know, I know that you've done kind of the business case work, and I think we, Representative Downey, you have seen the document, I guess. You indicated that maybe it's at too high a level. And we talked about the business process that you have to, you have limited number of vendors to select. And so some of the process review you haven't been able to do because it depends on what the systems are going to enable. But I guess the thing that I think would be very helpful for us as we're looking for ways to advocate for funding this is something, a document that we can point to that shows the return on investment for doing it. Just like internal controls and good accounting and good financial management is an essential part of any government entity, I think that having a system that can enable that is an essential part of it. So I don't think it's something that we're just adding to existing agencies, but if we're collecting $1 of public funds, we have to be able to track that $1. If we're collecting 32, 33, 34 billion, I mean, which is, you know, whatever the numbers turn out to be, we have to be able to account for all that money very effectively. And so it's not fun. It's not as compelling as a lot of other cases we're going to see, but it helps us if we had some very strong documentation about what the system can mean and what the return on investment will be. So I'm hoping that we can develop that if it's not already, if there isn't already a strong document in place.
Madam Chair, Representative Winkler, on our website right now, the MAPS replacement website, and I think Ms. Roberts has the direct link to pass on to you, page 13 of the updated business case has a chart that shows you the savings. Again, they're further out than the budget that you're trying to solve right now. And so, but they do provide you with some dollars that show you in a very specific, direct way what kind of savings the system would have. I would say in terms of the challenge you have, the challenge we had too in making the case to the governor after several years of talking about the system, there is a lot of things state government is supposed to do. There's a lot that we're all hoping gets done, even in the challenging budget times. Programs you expect to deliver, individuals, school districts, local governments that are expecting the funds. This system is fundamental to making sure we can all deliver on those promises. And so there is a piece of that that's hard to capture in an ROI, but it's certainly, to your point, Madam Chair, from the last hearing about how do you make the case for this versus programs for sick kids. We had that same struggle in the process, and in the end, the governor felt as if we have a system that goes clunk, and we have families or local governments sitting there expecting their check and not getting it. That's a true failure for state government in something that we all want to avoid. And so that was, again, recognizing the challenge you have. We want to help you with that, too. We did the best we could at trying to reduce the cost in this biennium by using a lease purchase financing mechanism, and I know you're going to hear more about that today. But we'll certainly keep talking with you about ways to demonstrate the value that we think the system has.
Madam Chair, to do a follow-up, the funding that we provided last session for the planning, Is it been through a consultant that you have spent that money and done the planning? You might have covered this already, but I guess I'm just wondering what your actual expenditure of funds has been for putting the planning together, how you use the money, and where that has led us.
Madam Chair, Representative, the planning funding that was provided last year was used in a small part for some travel to other states to see their systems, to talk with their staff about their implementations, their lessons learned, their areas where they were satisfied with their new system, areas where they wished they'd done things differently. We also have a contract in place with a consulting firm that specializes in public sector ERP selection and contracting. They don't provide actual implementation services, but rather specialize in the space of the project that we're in currently in terms of planning and procurement strategy. The balance we would expect to use for project management services from this point currently through the end of the fiscal year when project funding would be available if this is funded.
Who is that particular consultant?
The name of the firm, Madam Chair, is Advisor Teal and Associates. They're out of Austin, Texas.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and thank you for the emails that I got with some of the documents that we had asked for last time, and I didn't get a chance to review those again, and I'll just make one comment. I think the detail on the return on investment still seems a little sketchy, and I did look at, I think it was maybe even a 10-year return on investment, but the big numbers were in procurement, and there were some estimated numbers in just basic efficiency savings, but there was no ability to kind of look under those those overall numbers and know whether they were guesses or estimates based on other states, and the overall business case, I think is what the document was called, seemed to be a little bit still oriented towards what other states had experienced. So I'd maybe echo Representative Winkler's call for just maybe one layer deeper on the return on investment. And then I also appreciated the process documentation that you sent, but I did have a question following that. You indicated that pretty much every state agency plus MNSCU was going to move to the new accounting system and therefore these new accounting functions and processes. Did you guys analysis of that look at whether or not you could actually consolidate functions? For example, I think we heard from Mr. Nobles that maybe there were, I don't know, 24 or 36 cash receiving functions in human services alone. Did you look at collapsing those and really kind of consolidating functions as well as improving the business process?
Madam Chair, Representative, let me first make a comment about the MNSCU point. MNSCU currently uses the MAP accounting system, but at makes most of their transaction entries at a summary level. They have a subsystem of their own that incorporates student enrollment, financial aid, classroom planning, many of their mission-specific functions, and then there is an electronic interface to the accounting system, which post transactions at a summary level, but they still use the primary accounting system for payment processing, for example. So those, so we have the efficiency of combining payments and generating payments which combine across agencies. In terms of the receipt processing example, I think some of what you're asking about is not a system-related issue. That some of that, if business processes were changed today, could be captured differently in the current accounting system. So our work was focused on the system capabilities and how they would be different from our current system.
So just to clarify, I mean, hypothetically, if there's 25 places that were doing cash receipts in human services and there's 100 people doing it, we didn't explore whether that could be one cash receipting function and 10 people doing it. We're just focused on trying to improve the system functionality compared to really looking at kind of optimizing operations. Is that a fair statement or not fair?
Yes, that's fair.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, if I could, Representative Downey, Madam Chair, I think that that's fair. I also think, though, that it's fair to this point in the system development. And so certainly I think as we start talking about putting the system in place, that is something that we would want to continue to talk about, expect to talk about with agencies. It's partly why we have such a broad representation on the systems team across state agencies, because we know they have to take back what they learn about the system to their agencies to say, hey, here's the process that's really going to be changing a lot. Let's look at how we can get our own processes lined up. We talked in the last hearing about, I think Representative Winkler asked about lean. Again, it's other prostitutes too, that I think we need to work really hard with agencies to say, how do you take the new system and leverage it to create other change in your agency? So I think that we're talking about the work that's been done today really has focused on the system piece of it. The next phase really is for state agencies to keep looking at how they change their own internal processes.
I think just a comment in response to that, and we'll talk more about the lease purchase financing, but I know it's more work on the front end to try and model out where you can actually standardize and consolidate the business function. But if you look out into years 3, 4, and 5, I mean, if the consolidation of functions is where the real dollar savings are, and you can pull those forward and realize them through the system implementation and start to realize those in years 3 and 4, the case for lease purchase financing gets a lot stronger. So I'll just make that comment and say, let's talk more about that when we get to lease purchase. Okay. Thank you.
Representative Polk. Thank you. Madam Chair, as far as funding the system upgrade, was there ever any consideration given to a chargeback to the other agencies, if you will, similar to how we fund the lobbying office in Washington, D.C., or some of the governor's staff?
Madam Chair, Representative Colbert, I think we looked at every option possible. With a system of this size, $70 million, there aren't a lot of, it's harder to fund than the Washington, D.C. chargeback. The agencies already pay for the operation of the MAP system through the statewide systems account, and so they already, there's a piece of that they already pay for on an ongoing basis and have since implementation of the statewide systems project in the mid-90s. We felt in the governor's budget as if that, given the other cuts agencies were taking and given the environment that we're in, that wasn't something that we could put on top of agencies to charge back the full amount. We would expect, again, as we look at implementing the system when it's operational, that the operations costs would be paid for in the same way that they are with the current system.
And my solution to that is a little bit different. My solution would be to funnel the approach, to make that decision at the start and to reduce the appropriation, to essentially make that calculation and funnel the appropriation to those agencies for information management through OET, and then go from OET out to there. That's how I would deal with that issue, instead of trying to do a chargeback.
And Madam Chair, if I might, did you do any initial calculations or any idea of what that would look like, or on a percentage of their budget, or when you were considering it, how deep did you go, and give any idea how much it would have cost on a percentage or per agency or transaction kind of basis?
Madam Chair, Representative Holbert, I'm going to leave that to the budget folks when they talk about the financing side of it. Again, we looked at a lot of different options, and I think they'll probably be able to answer that for you better than I could right now.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I haven't had a chance to look at the business case in detail other than just looking over Representative Winkler's shoulder there, but I understand that the system would go live July 1, 2011, and so I'm curious if, rather than jump to the solution, maybe just if you, I'll ask open any question about how the stimulus recovery dollars are being currently planned to be accounted for and tracked, and whether that's a clean enough slate opportunity to find a way to test drive some parts of the system. I think I may be a year ahead of myself there, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Thielen, probably don't have enough time in the day to talk about that in full, but good question. Certainly, I think that, again, Mr. Stolwater might be able to answer that better when he comes up to talk about the financing, because he's also working on the stimulus. We're looking at a couple of different options of what systems we might use to track those dollars. So we're going to try to find the best option there. But I suppose that question to him, probably able to help you out.
And just a quick question at a global level. Is it true of the folks I've been working with at the Office of Energy Security have alluded to establishing a 400 code in addition to 300 codes for federal funds, and this 400 would be the stimulus funds? Is that, am I accurate in getting that information passed along to me?
Madam Chair, Representative Kaelin, I'm not sure on the code. Again, you may get better information from the folks later. I know that we have sent out information to agencies telling them to establish a specific code so that any data coming through MAPS would have an identifiable code as federal stimulus dollars.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair, can I follow up on a question from Representative Downey? You talked about basically, you know, sort of the Al Gore reinvention of government kind of thing, where you really talk about looking at agencies and trying to use the technology available to cut down on the number of cash collection sites, or really looking at the kind of big picture and detail, both, I guess, of the business process and how we can do things better. And the question would be, is this MAP system replacement the best time to do that? And I guess even more so, is that really in the cards, I guess? Because you're talking about really forcing agencies to do a pretty hard analysis, and my guess is that the Department of Finance isn't necessarily, and even admin, aren't really geared for doing that kind of wholesale re-examination of the agencies and seeing how that maps the software. So is this, would doing what Representative Downey is describing be more of an entirely new initiative beyond what's in place right now in the agencies?
Madam Chair, Representative Whistler, it's a good question and a hard question. I think that I guess the way I'd start answering it, at least, is that all agencies right now are involved to some extent in some wholesale redefinition of what they do, because they have to be. With the kind of cuts that we've been taking, it seems to me in some respect it's a perfect opportunity to be looking at those things, because forget system changes, there is any number of incentives out there in the world for people to be looking at 24 different cash receipt processes and changing them. And so this system is another point to leverage that conversation, but I think that all of us, speaking for our own agency, that's what we're involved in right now, because we have to be. And again, with the workforce changes coming upon us, losing a lot of good people where a lot of knowledge rests that could maintain a complicated system, we all have to be looking at how to change that. So in some ways it might be the right time to do that by necessity.
Yeah, thank you. And I think your answer is a very fair one. It's a tough decision. But just to point out, I don't think your RFP right now is written to essentially get a new accounting system, implement that across the agencies, and then it would be left for another time to try and do a broader consolidation. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable strategy. I don't know all the facts. It's certainly an option, and you could choose that for very good reasons. When we talk about lease purchase financing and look at where the return on investment is, or the return is that would actually justify the increased cost of the lease, I think that becomes a little more of a focal point. And you know, these are big monstrous projects, and they're extremely painful. To think that you'd do that for two full years and then all of a sudden turn around and take on another kind of departmental agency reorg and functional consolidation and all that for another two or three years after that, that's a lot of institutional effort. So I think there is a reality based to think that you would just immediately move towards capturing the real benefits in years 3, 4, and 5 when you just barely survived getting the system in. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Downey, if I could, I don't think we see them as subsequent to the systems project. It has to be part of the project going forward. It doesn't mean necessarily that it's part of the contract with the vendor or the integrators, but certainly, again, the agencies involved in looking at, in part, if you just look in very practical terms, this project team is made up of 65 state staff and it has a fair amount of state staff already going towards it, pulling people out of agencies that are experts in their field, moving them into the project. That already creates an impetus for any agency to say, hey, wait a minute, we got to look at what we're doing and figure out a different way to do it. They can't wait for 2 years for that project to be done. We're already looking at our own agency, again, using a small example of saying, so given that we know these five folks are going to move off to the project, what do we do now to change what we're doing every day on the way paper comes in, who touches it, who does it, what do we do now to get ready for that change? That's happening across state government. So I don't want to leave the impression that doesn't happen until after. It can't wait. Too much transformation of state government happens the very minute this project goes into place, and is already happening as agencies prepare for it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then I guess the question is, what is being done to be deliberate about that? And do we have the is leadership in place in order to take advantage of that? I mean, what you're saying and what Downey is suggesting is likely the case, that you sort of have a window to do this, both as a matter of concentration, effort, focus, and when you're spending the money, and have people thinking about it. So is there a deliberate effort in place kind of across agencies to take advantage of that opportunity? Or if so, could something more be done, or should it be done?
Madam Chair, Representative Whitler, part of that goes to the work that OET and admin and finance have been doing to look at IT consolidation efforts, enterprise email, data center consolidation, all of the things that OET has been working on, the work that admin has been doing too. All of those, again, start to get at backroom processes and try to provide a different look at it. So that's I would say, the work outside of the or involved in the Drive to Excellence, and all the very many projects there have been the coordinated way that we've been approaching it to date.
Okay, I think we need to move on. Who's ever going to lead the discussion on the financing? Is there anything that you think we need to discuss more on this today?
No, Madam Chair. Thank you for the chance. We're eager to have to find a way to fund it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Roberts has just pointed out to members that you were emailed links to all of the information that we're talking about last week. So, look in your back emails from Robert. Use Roberts and find. And okay. All right. Thank you. Who's ever starting? Mr. Showalter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Jim Showalter, for the record, State Budget Director. Pleased to have the opportunity to discuss IT financing with you today. It's certainly been a topic that we've been looking at and discussing for a number of years, both in committee, within the administration, with national associations as well. John Lally and I helped work on a NASCO report that came out not so long ago. Abby Reed, who will be presenting some of this presentation, worked with OET as well to present a I think, very useful blueprint for within Minnesota, how we approach IT financing, and it's certainly been a topic that we've been looking at for a long while. Part of the reason is just because it's big money. Infrastructure, IT, is hard to come by. It's not like the state isn't familiar with large IT investments. You go back a couple of years, the last biennial budget included about $90 million for education information technology, all money that went out to school districts. Last year, about $60 million went into the Department of Vehicle Services for a computer system to help make sure that that system ran well. Yet, it is difficult to make sure that we find ways to finance the core systems, even as those systems get older and older and are very expensive, and at risk of breaking down.
Okay, Representative Bigham.
Thank you. To the testifier, is that one-time money? Is some of that one-time money that went out to the school districts and Department of Motor Vehicles?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, this was all one-time. Both figures are one-time. I know, as with Ms. Andrews, I came to the then Department of Finance roughly 15 years ago as MAPS was being developed and was being implemented, and it was a massive undertaking. The department worked throughout trying to look at ways to use that system to leverage some of the business reforms that the representatives have been talking about, try to make it work. It became almost an opportunity for a blank slate of government operations. That's essentially what's being looked at here. The financing aspects to put down, is trying to find ways to use some of the existing techniques, existing financing mechanisms that we have, and apply them here for core services. On the first slide, you see a discussion of lease purchasing. It's a common practice. It's a common vehicle for financing activities, even within Minnesota. It has just not been used here for IT financing. You'll see a little bit more in this presentation about how we've used it for different types of activities, including equipment purchases. It's also been used for some of the buildings that state agencies are currently in, such as the Department of Human Services building just down the street. It is different than a general obligation bond. It is different than a upfront appropriation, but it is one way to spread out some of those costs so that the benefits over time can be recognized in sync with the costs that the state has to pay. I should note before I go on, the Department of Finance has always preferred money on the table for these kinds of one-time investments. We still would. We recognize that it would always be best if the state could find the money, use that for one-time purchases. I think given the business case that you're looking here, given the resources and constraints that the state is under, that is why the governor's recommendation comes as it does, looking for ways to spread some of that cost. And I think also recognize that there's some really valid business reasons for trying to spread those costs. On the next page, I just wanted to put this in a continuum. We've back and forth, both formally and informally, talked about general obligation bonding for IT purchases. That is an understandable tool in many states. Given the constitution that we have, and Assistant Commissioner Kathy Cardell can certainly speak to that more authoritatively than I can, but in all of the meetings that we've had with bond counsel and other parties, we've seen no reason to believe that that is a financing option that the state has currently.
Could someone give us those constitutional provisions that are in this state and the constitutional provision to compare with the constitutional provision in the other states that allow it? The state I put up right, because I know right away, is Massachusetts. But if there are other states that are doing it, I'd like to look at what the relevant language in their constitution says. I still maintain that the people who wrote this constitution really didn't know that they should exclude massive information purchases as part of the things that are excluded from general obligation bonds. So I'd, again, like to have some people with maybe more imagination than bond counsel looking at it.
Well, Madam Chair, the problem is you don't get to ask anybody with more imagination than bond counsel. and I tried. I actually went to a bond lawyer at Fagerie and Benson to see if he saw any error in the Dorsey and Whitney bond counsel opinion on this topic,
but he
found out that he agreed that it was a reasonable opinion and that the standard for bond counsel agree to spending for geo bonds is extremely high. And so they're not only are they cautious by nature, but the professional standard for agreeing to it is such that
that's why we want to look at these constitutions in other states.
We'd have to change the constitution to convince bond counsel.
No, we need to look at the constitutions in other states, and we need to look at what bond counsels they use. First we have to.
So, Madam Chair, continuing on, general obligation bond, extraordinarily high standard, a very mature market, very clear processes, and as Representative Winkler says, we really, it's not a place where imagination is allowed. And so, at this point in time, if we're looking at these projects, what other options might we have? Revenue bonds are an option if there was a revenue source that went with it. And I mentioned this before, the DDS system. Now, a fee was adopted that basically funded that system. That becomes more difficult for central core systems that are essentially the backbone of the enterprise. There isn't a real good fee structure that could be tacked on to that. So even as we explore some of the options, and we'll answer some of the earlier questions about how much an agency assessment would go, I just want to warn you that that does enter into the indirect cost pool and all kinds of other fun issues that we'll come up with that. So
what about the point that Representative Holberg was kind of making. If you put a revenue, you know, you put in state law a revenue stream that specifically addressed the people who are going to use that. Why is that any less valid a revenue stream than a driver's license revenue stream or a vehicle revenue stream?
Madam Chair, my name is Kathy Cardell. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget. You know, the issue with revenue streams and revenue bonds is always the source of those dollars. So if you pledge revenue, if you want to create a revenue bond structure, but you want to assess agencies a fee, that money is coming out of, presumably, for most agencies, the general fund, which is primarily funded from tax revenues. We cannot use tax revenues as a resource to pay off revenue bonds.
So the challenge, Madam Chair, is to find a revenue stream that is not tax-supported that would be there to back those bonds. Otherwise, as Assistant Commissioner Cardell says, it becomes public debt, which led us to the next box on the presentation.
Can I have just a little clarification? Since the state law says, no, a fee is a tax, is there any way that you could ever have a fee?
Yes. Madam Chair and Representative Solberg, bond counsel has not been very comfortable in relying upon that provision. They look at the characteristics of the fee in question, and in fact, that is the reason why the motor vehicle transfer fee that was proposed to repay the landfill closure revenue bond was deemed, no matter what it was called, to be more applicable as a general tax than it was to be a fee commensurate with the services that was supposed to provide.
So, Madam Chair, maybe that would be more emphasis to be able to repeal that law, but it looks like the repeal may not help very much.
Okay. So, what about, for example, the lottery receipts, which has 60% going to the Environmental Trust Fund and then 40% goes to the General Fund? What about those, even though they're now going to the General Fund, what about taking that as a source of money?
Madam Chair, the lottery receipts are considered non-dedicated, non-tax revenues, and so those would be an acceptable
source. Okay. You just need a little imagination.
We have done that before.
We did that for the Cambridge bond.
Right.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, Representative Solberg is right. The Cambridge bond issue was a one-time court settlement, and we basically rounded up every possible fee that we could in order to put together an issuance that was revenue-backed to fill that gap.
But for example, in terms of revenue bonds with the lottery would not, you know, right now it is going into the general fund, but the point is, the point is legally we could do that as repayment for revenue bonds.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess one of the things is that we would like to have some analysis of the different costs of lease purchasing, you know, as long as I'm sure that that's more than enough for an annual payoff of revenue bonds.
Madam Chair, yes, and that's why, let me get to the lease purchase option, because the first two options, the revenue bonds and the GO bonds, have been things that we have discussed back and forth over years and have run into those very constraints as we try to make them work. The lease purchase is only a little bit different than the last topic that we've discussed, but as I mentioned before, it hasn't been really discussed as an IT tool.
Okay.
It is, in terms of financing costs, very similar to what you would be looking at under a revenue bond scenario, and has different considerations that for the financing agreement between ourselves and whoever would ultimately be financing this option. The last, and we'll talk some more about vendor financing in one session, the last to the far end is sort of the vendor financing. Rather than going to the market and getting the best financing deal possible, you're essentially going to an individual or company that would actually deliver the service and saying, you finance it for it as well. Typically, we would have some concerns about that just because you now have lost both some of the efficiencies of the finance market, and also you've lost some of the flexibility in negotiating and running the project because your vendor is not only delivering your product, but is in charge of the books as well.
Mr. Showalter, I guess if given that we've just we have some precedent, I guess, for using the lottery proceeds to back revenue bonds, I think it would be useful to at least see a comparison of the cost between the lease purchase and the revenue bond numbers. It might not be huge, but I think it would be useful for us to actually see what those numbers look like.
Madam Chair, Representative, okay. we can certainly do that. It's second, what would be the issues or the differences? Certainly there being some assumption of interest rates, but ironically, because the lease purchase bond would be
lease purchase isn't a bond.
Lease purchase isn't a bond, but it's a debt to vehicle, a debt instrument, would probably have a higher rating than the revenue bond would under this situation.
Madam Chair?
One
of the questions I have in a revenue bond, though, is you usually have to have a larger stream of revenue to be able to pass a revenue bond. And as a general rule, is it three times as much?
Representative Silver and Manchair, I would say with the lottery security, as a lottery revenue security, that might even be on the low side. It might have to be higher than that. And so you would really need to establish a high level of what we call debt service coverage that would have to be in place each year. And then usually the way that those revenue bonds are structured, it is released at the end of a year. If it's not, once it's determined that it's not needed to pay debt service, but it would be, I think, a more expensive proposition than a lease purchase financing.
Madam Chair, I think you need to examine it because I think the funds in the lottery are fairly large, and I don't know how that compares to what the cost is on it.
And also look at it, the structure that we put in for the Cambridge Bank bond.
That's right.
Didn't we? We backed it with the property taxes of the state, didn't we? Financially or not?
Madam Chair, no. Those bonds were not.
No.
They were not.
Okay.
They were purely secured by the lottery receipts, the departmental fees and earnings, which there was, as Representative Silver said, an exhaustive analysis to make sure there was nothing that looked like a tax, and I believe also Medicaid reimbursement.
Madam Chair, to that point as well, in the Cambridge example or in the revenue bond scenario that we're discussing, that coverage it does have a budget implication, so that you're going to have to dedicate a larger stream of revenue in order to back that bond, so that for budget purposes you're going to tie up more resources to make sure that that vehicle has adequate coverage than under a lease purchase scenario that we're thinking that we'll go into further.
Okay.
So just in terms of, if you had to make a $100 million or a $10 million payment, you might have to have 12 or more million dollars available for budget purposes in order to back that revenue bond than you might under a lease purchase kind of scenario. And that's just depending on the vehicle, the financing vehicle you're talking about and the terms of that agreement.
Okay.
So let's just talk about some of the other
things. Representative Downey,
thank you, Mr. Actually, staying on page 3, is there another option, a fifth option, which would kind of use a term outsourcing, where you actually could, as part of your RFP, require the hosting and management and entire support and service provision, ask the vendor to provide that, and would that allow us to simply then pay those the fees for the outsourcing agreement as expenses compared to some kind of asset acquisition that implies these other things? Is there a way to do this on an expense stream through outsourcing?
Madam Chair, our representative, yes, and that's sort of the vendor financing model where they would have access to capital. They might have a higher cost of capital than the state would. In fact, it's almost certain they would. Public debt is relatively... It is among the safest, best-rated obligations, but certainly you could outsource it. They could finance the facilities, and you could then essentially buy that service from them and make that as part of your service and capital agreement.
Is that really a capital? I mean, all you're doing is procuring a service as compared to... the lease purchase assumes that we ultimately want to own the product at the end of the financing term, and then I know state government is very much into owning the intellectual property at the end of it. I get that, but an outsourcing arrangement would, with the right service level agreement, provide you all of those protections and allow you to do this on an expense stream. It's just you don't have the stuff in your data centers, and you're paying some, and you know you're paying profit margin to them for that, so there's a cost to it, but at least from a payment stream, you're doing it as an expense. Is that, have I characterized it? You could structure this as an expense that way, or am I mischaracterizing it?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe you're characterizing it correctly. Checking with Ms. Reed if there's...
No.
If there's any clarification.
Okay.
No, I think we'd agree.
Madam Chair, I guess there's, I don't know, the question back to Representative Downey or to anybody else, but that I think assumes that there would be a vendor with a system built that was ready to go that could provide the service without a significant capital outlay to begin with. So it seems to me that one way or the other, you're going to end up paying for a big capital outlay. Your question is whether you're doing it internally or externally, and how you're spreading it out. As far as the payments go, I can see you're spreading them out. But one way or the other, the construction of the service or the software system to provide the service is going to cost money. It's not going to be something that's just, you can just log into and go.
Madam Chair, the vendor community, frankly, is very prepared and very interested in those kinds of arrangements and are hosting innumerable Fortune 1000 organizations, systems, and providing that exact service. So if we had structured the RFP to ask for those kinds of service offerings as part of the solution that they're proposing, you would in fact see a variety of vendors competing for that business, and they're very interested in it. So it's not as though they build it custom for the state of Minnesota. They would just add us into their data center in Texas or wherever it is and provide the service and support, and I have done numerous acquisitions like that.
If I could follow up with Representative Downey then, but don't you, I think the testimony before was that there are only about three vendors that provide this system, and so is it just as easy, you think, as the same people who do it for Target can do it for the state of Minnesota, or are you talking about a specialized service that is particular to state government as an enterprise that might be different and more necessary to be custom, I guess?
Madam Chair, if I could just clarify, are we talking about master data centers? Because I think there is also a material difference,
yes,
in the service, because the accounting system is pretty customized. That states have different structures than the private sector. They have different structures even from each other, the states. Data centers are more back office functions that should be more similar. Hopefully all of those will be becoming more similar over time. But I think there's probably a material difference as to whether a vendor could come in and do an accounting system versus a data center. And I just wanted to check which one we were talking about, or both.
Madam Chair,
Madam Chair, my question takes us to a slightly different area, but I'd let this run out, I think.
I can offer a response. It's actually both. There are companies that do data center outsourcing, and I think that's part of the mix with what OET is currently considering as we look at data center consolidation. As we do that, does the state want to own that, or does the state want somebody else to own it and we just pay for the service to provide it? The comment that was made, I think, somewhere along the way by the project team for MAPS is that there's a very limited number of software packages that are a potential fit for the state of Minnesota, and that's a very limited number. I mean, less than five, and maybe realistically only two or three. But in terms of the service providers, there are a number of large system integrators, including the big companies, the IBMs and the Unisys and the Deloittes and the Accentures of the world, that would be very interested in proposing on an entire outsourced contract where they would do the data center hosting, they would provide all the implementation services, they would provide the ongoing support, and they would do that on an outsourced basis so that none of that even fits in a physical facility here at the state, and we just pay for it. So those options are potentially available. You might not like the cost comparison as you look at it, but there are people who are interested in doing it.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I've been trying to, I'm on the edge of, in my internal dilemma about whether this is constructive or just curious. I don't know that it always is, but Representative Solberg and I were having a sidebar, and I thought it would settle my question, and I don't think it has. So, going back to GO, and I'm sorry I missed a little bit of the discussion, but this notion of piggybacking of, for instance, that I'm most familiar, an analog is when our locals purchase fire trucks and they piggyback as much soft gear as they can into the truck for both financing and also for sales tax exemption. And I'm just wondering about how far, where's the limit on piggybacking with physical structures and going to longer capital investment there?
Yes, to the concept, I think, also fits into the concept of the data center.
Right.
The data center is going to be a business. How much of that data set, how much of the information management going into that data center could go into the GO bonding for the data center?
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, the use of general obligation bond financing is very likely able to be used to finance not only the construction of a physical building, but also all of the costs related to equipping and furnishing that building to carry out its governmental purpose.
Interesting.
Yep.
So that's a different interpretation than what we've had in the past.
No, I'm not sure that it is. I'm not sure that we've ever actually asked that question to do this. I mean,
let me ask that question. Have we ever asked that question?
Madam Chair, I've got a few opinions, so let me just double check for 1 second if you want to keep on with your discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, I think the question has been asked lots of times, and from other bond councils or other people have said, if you're building a building, you can include in that building, in the bond, the wiring and all the things that stay inside the building, but you cannot include in the bond the computer that can be removed from the building. That's my understanding. Now, maybe I'm misinterpreting a computer from a mainframe computer, but the life of a mainframe computer is probably not the same life as the life of a building or the bond. So that's been other interpretations. I don't know if I'm stand corrected or not.
No, Madam Chair, on the question of the specifically the data center consolidation facilities, I'm looking at an opinion that was written by Bond Council back in 2000, and it doesn't specifically, I looked through it very quickly, it doesn't specifically talk about data centers, but it talks about technology centers, including computer or service rooms and related wiring closets. But they were talking about this specifically in the context of like improving existing state buildings. As we were talking about this system, the MAP financing and all of the data center discussion, we did also have a separate conversation with Bond Council, which we've not expressed an opinion, but specifically on the question of, you know, if the state decided to construct a data center, you know, what elements would be potentially eligible for GO financing, and they, you know, their attitude was, when you look at public, you know, debt, it's publicly owned, which if we were using GO bonds, it have to be publicly owned, it has to be for governmental purpose, which this clearly would be, and we clearly allow that when we construct a new facility that we are able to do all of the wiring and security and furnishings and finishings that are necessary to make that building fulfill its intended purpose.
And then, Madam Chair, that raises another question for me about renovation and retrofitting, and at what point we reach that. I can actually share with you that we have a definition in statute now, or I don't think it's actually a definition yet. I think it's a very strong recommendation related to energy that establishes, I think, 10,000 square feet, or a complete rehab or overhaul of the central heating or mechanical system. So the question is, at what point do you actually start to get at, where's that edge? Have you had that conversation yet?
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, not specifically on that, and I would tell you that whenever we start going down the road of
you know, a specific, especially if we're going to talk about retrofitting or renovating, that bond counsel will want to look at that on a case-by-case basis. Again, in this 2000 opinion, they give several examples whereby they feel that GO bonds could be used in conjunction with retrofitting or renovating buildings to accommodate some technology purposes. They're very clear about the fact we can't finance systems like MAP or integrated tax with GO bonds. And also with respect to the life of some of these systems, I would say that we need to remember that even though state GO bonds are typically issued for 20 years, we don't need to always sell. In fact, we don't always structure things to amortize over 20 years. If the useful life is intended to be shorter, we can and do structure it that way. So that, you know, it has implications, as Representative Solberg knows, in terms of, you know, the debt limit. This pushes debt service forward if we amortize something shorter, but it's not something that we can't do. We certainly can do that.
So one last question, Madam Chair, along these lines, okay. And I'd like to get a copy of the opinion just for my own understanding. So then the question of piggybacking shows, you know, comes up for me of, and I don't know if this is a term of art, it's just a colloquialism, I guess, but you know, if we were to bond GO for a data center and to incorporate some of the hardware or some of the platform, some of the physical platform required to make MAP work, then are we piggybacking enough that we're making that? I'm merely trying to understand both where the boundary is, but also constructively for us if there's a hole in the Swiss cheese that we can crawl through.
Madam Chair and Representative Taylor, you know, I would say that would be something. I couldn't speak to whether bond counsel would be comfortable. Okay. They would need to look at that. Again, with these purchase financing for MAP, we gave them the RFP because we wanted them to look at what we were asking for in order to help us assess what could be financed through a lease purchase on a tax-exempt basis, and they would, you know, do a similar sort of analysis with this if there was a general obligation bonding proposal to try to determine if it all fits.
Okay. And Madam Chair, Representative, my name is Abigail Reed. I'm a budget officer at MMB, and one of the issues I know the folks from MAP would tell you is that the portion that it is equipment and other things like that of the total MAP proposal is actually a very small amount. So it's the cost of the state staff and the services, and that's why in this case lease purchase financing is recommended, because that is a better vehicle for financing those sorts of things than the GO bond.
We'll just continue on with the presentation. Obviously, this is a detailed and intricate area, and you know, what we're looking at is different financing tools that are available to the state, different ways that it has to be paid for, could be paid for, and then, you know, the value of the investment that you're assessing. Going through that continuum, all of these tools are there. These are not unique considerations. We've been talking about them for a while. The governor's recommendations on the lease purchase method, and Abby will walk you through some more information.
One said, Johnny, if you do any good in this point.
No, thank you.
Okay.
You're just assuming
that. I don't know if old ones not crossed out or new ones or whatever. Okay.
Madam Chair, as I said before, my name is Abby Reed, and I'm a budget officer. And I'm going to turn to the next slide that's titled How It Works. And basically how this works is private investors would purchase our certificates of participation, and in exchange they would receive a fixed rate of return, which is actually what the certificates of participation then provide us, the upfront capital, for the major systems development in exchange for fixed lease payments. And unlike what you might think of with a traditional lease, like when you lease a car or a building, it's not secured actually by the asset. In this case, the lease is entirely secured by the amount we would appropriate from time to time for the lease repayment. And because of that, because it's not backed by the full faith and credit of the state, like general obligation bonding, it would be slightly riskier for investors, which they would then demand a slightly higher interest rate. Turning to the next slide, we have a little bit of information on other states' experiences. As Mr. Showalter mentioned, the National Association of State Chief Information Officers recently released a 2008 update of their previous, I think it was 2003 study, of IT financing in use across the states. And they actually showed an increase in that report in the use of this particular financing tool, lease purchase. And they showed that 19 states in their survey use lease purchase financing for technology, with at least 6 states using this particular form, which is certificates of participation, to purchase their IT systems. As the next slide shows,
how big is that study? What is it? Is it an article? Is it a volume?
Madam Chair,
that a volume?
Monstrous. It is I'm trying to remember the size. It's a reasonable size report. We could certainly get it.
Ms. Robinson, as true as I see it, you copy it.
Yes.
Okay.
Of course, I want to get in. So I'm just looking at this certificate. What couldn't we use lease purchasing for? I mean, it sort of looks like it's just an end around against the prohibition on borrowing from biennium to biennium. And how does this compare to a tobacco appropriation bond?
Madam Chair and Representative Winkler, fundamentally, the lease payments that you would be making under a certificate of participation structure that is included here is identical. They're all subject to appropriation. They're not considered public debt because they are made on a fiscal year to fiscal year basis.
So, Madam Chair, the follow-up then, you're paying more because essentially they've got no guarantee that you're going to make the payment. If we decide not to pay, we don't pay, and they're out the money. What is their remedy?
Medicare and Representative Winkler, I need to be more careful about that too. The obligations are subject to appropriation because they are a current fiscal year obligation of the state. If you choose not to appropriate, that is absolutely the right of the legislature. The reality is that the credit rating impact and market access impact is great, because what people assume, and maybe to speak directly to your question about what we can't lease purchase financing is really most relevant when it is being used for essential purposes. People that lease purchase ice arenas, not considered to be so highly essential by investors. Folks that are lease purchasing buildings to house state offices, that are financing core state systems, as this case might be, from a credit rating and from an investor perspective, those are considered to be highly essential purposes.
Madam Chair, so the reason why...
I thought all our ice arenas were done with GOs on.
Only in Marshall, Madam Chair.
The reason why the core services or pieces are relevant here is because they don't think we're going to stop using what we absolutely need to use, and that's where they see the risk mitigation.
Madam Chair, Representative, I should note that that's part of the recommendation here. Obviously, the Department of Finance has always had concerns about the use of and how do you draw the line. And when we're talking about this tool, financing tool for information technology, we would recommend it to this committee, using only for core sort of statewide systems. But that's the appropriate place where this financing tool makes sense. Otherwise, you may be looking at other types of fees or other types of options for financing them.
And Madam Chair, last year I carried a bill for state and local governments' lease purchase financing mechanism for public building energy efficiency and Public Building Enhanced Energy Efficiency Program, PB. In that case, the revenue was the future energy savings. But during the payback period, you pay that back, but it was securitized. It wasn't really securitized. It was leveraged to be made attractive by an escrow fund from essentially a tobacco-style settlement from, I think it was ExxonMobil in 84. But so that was what made it attractive. You had this guarantee. It was not likely that these public buildings are going to be shut down, so the energy was going to continue to be used. And then if you had a year that was especially harsh in terms of winter, that you would get the supplemental cash flow by drawing down this escrow fund. I'm curious, where's that backstop in this program that can... Because at some point, I think you actually could use lease purchase for anything. The question is, would you actually get would it be marketable? Would you be able to get somebody to buy the certificates, right?
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, I think you're exactly right. In years past, and I've been doing this for a really long time before I came to state government, these sorts of lease purchase financings oftentimes had what we call debt service reserve funds attached to them,
yeah.
Kind of similar, usually funded from the proceeds of the transaction itself and available to make payments in the event that someone screwed up the appropriation, something bad happened. In recent years, that has gone away as being a credit requirement, and what investors have relied on more recently, and when I say recently, in the last 5 years maybe, is really the critical nature of whatever it is that we're acquiring with the proceeds of that transaction. And the essentiality, as Representative Winkler said, that, you know, the idea that you're just going to walk away and without a state accounting system is probably sort of remote.
And, Madam Chair, I think it does, I'm actually getting slightly more troubled, and not by your answers, just the more that we get into this, the more that the credit markets have fundamentally changed. And I don't know that they have changed temporarily. I think they may have changed for a decade or two, maybe longer. And so I'm wondering if there are other states that have gone down this road, and probably not, since it's only been 4 or 5 months since the collapse of the credit market. And are we going to go back to having to have some sort of backstops? And I think it'd be interesting to get something more in depth from BOD Council and to see where we're going with this.
Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, you're right. There hasn't really been a lot of financing activity in the last several months, and none that I could find that was specifically related to technology. It would surprise me if credit rating agencies and investors would require a state to provide that sort of backstop going forward. I've definitely seen that with local government issuers or other, perhaps, regardless of our financial situation here, with Prep Plus resources available to make an $8 million lease payment. But your question is very valid, and I think that is something that we're going to have to see how it develops as the markets continue to develop and evolve and be a little bit dysfunctional. Okay, I think Jim.
Yeah,
and then we have about 5 minutes and 3 slides, so we do need to get to so.
So maybe just to reiterate a comment,
yes,
that I made earlier, and I think you know, as you look at this, we are not securitizing an asset that has any real residual value other than its utility to us. It's not as though we have a building that we could sell or lease to somebody else. We're really just creating an expense stream for the state. And so,
if we start talking about the data center,
yes, you could actually have some kind of physical asset there. But in terms of the MAPS proposal specifically, which is again where I would come down on really doing what we could to pull the expense benefit or the expense reduction benefit forward into this project, so that this actually becomes of business value, if you will, or of financial value to the state. You know, if it were an asset that 30 years from now would have appreciated 5% a year, and you know, we're whole on our investment, that's different. Here, the only return on this investment is what we can do from a customer service or a cost takeout standpoint within the internal operations of state government. So that's why I've kind of been pushing hard on this idea of pulling the overall organizational benefits forward in the project as compared to leaving them for later.
There's also a conversation that was a little too long to work in today, and we'll try and get it in at some other point. There are two companies, there are a set of people who have been talking to us about the whole, the sense of outsourcing, and the question of how lease purchase differs from outsourcing. And, you know, they at some point would like to also make a presentation, and we'll try and work that in at some point. But
Madam Chair, members, the slide is titled Other States Experiences. Looking at a couple other states here, Ohio and Kentucky have used
This week purchased financing mechanism for similar type projects. Ohio financed a major ERP system. They did use the tax exempt certificates of participation and did use the 10-year repayment period that's also recommended in the governor's budget. Kentucky has actually used this in sort of a multi-layer fashion over multiple years, and they financed several systems that way, including a personnel system, a tax system, and their emergency communication system. And they, because it's multi-layered and multiple systems, have done it with a variety of repayment periods from 7 to 10 years. And as Mr. Showalter said earlier, we've actually used a lease purchase financing mechanism for real estate transactions, including the Freeman Anderson building and the DCA building in Bemidji. And actually, if you look back to the early history of our master lease program that's used for equipment purchases, we use something more like a certificate of participation model then too, although we've moved away from that model for that particular type of transaction in recent years. And also looking out to Wisconsin and North Dakota, they've used similar financing arrangements for statewide systems, and as I know some of you have experienced in local governments and elsewhere, elsewhere in Minnesota, they use similar arrangements. Turning to the next slide, this just outlines the two proposed projects for using lease purchase financing in the governor's budget, and shows the breakdown of how that would work. So in both cases, you'd have a total principal amount, and that's broken down into the actual project cost. That's the dollars that would flow to the agencies to actually purchase and implement the system. Then there's the administration cost, and that is similar to our bond sale expenses in the GO bond world. So this would be the cost of actually engaging with bond counsel consultants and others to actually let out the lease purchase financing arrangement. And then you'll see the bottom line there is the interest. The assumption in the governor's budget is an interest rate of 5%, and so the interest cost is shown there for each project. That would bring the total to over 10 years, $89.75 million for MAP and $19.795 million for integrated tax. And you'll see that if you break that down to the annual payments over 10 years, that's the amount that's booked in the governor's budget for the current biennium.
Madam Chair, the 5% number, I guess we don't, to Representative Kalin's question, we have no idea in this world. I mean, right now, government debt is really cheap for us to get money. And it may, something like this may be cheap because it's a state and relatively safe, or it may be expensive for some other reason. Do you have any
And Madam Chair, the 5% rate was looked at and determined as a conservative estimate back in December when we were doing some preliminary financial analyses. Subsequent to that, interest rates went down quite a bit, and we talked about the fact that, wow, you know, look at what happened on our GO bond sale. But then subsequent to that, rates have gone up quite a bit. I would say that in today's market, with a 10-year amortization as is proposed here, that we would certainly be below 5%. But whether that would be the case this summer, if we were to do that, is that's uncertain. Interest rates change every day.
Madam Chair, I guess the follow-up would be whether we could make the case that this is the time to do it. This is the time to lock in the rate, as it were, in this market, and that might be a good justification for, in this economic and budget moment, this is a time to be able to do this. This is the right time to do it.
Just don't do an arm.
Oh, Madam Chair, to this point as well, on energy stuff, we've been talking to bond councils and public finance folks around the world, and the conversation will change every 2 weeks. And I think that we may not know by the time that we assemble our final bills in the middle of May what that actually, that might change the 1st of June, mm-hmm. and for positive or negative. And so I think that we have to be very, very cautious about whether this 5%, there may be some hiccup and another part of the collapse, the credit card market might collapse, and all of a sudden, then we don't know. So I think we should be cautious. We have to look at this again in a couple of weeks to see where we're at.
In Madam Chair, if I may, Representative, that is not unfamiliar risk. Every time we do a general obligation bond issuance, we have that same kind of risk in estimating what our debt service payments are going to be. And so I think this current market is very volatile, but it is not a new phenomenon for us to try and work that through.
And also, Madam Chair and Representative Kalin, I would say, too, that notwithstanding the extreme volatility that Mr. Showalter has referenced on an absolute basis, when you look historically, believe it or not, interest rates are still quite low.
I do believe that.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll point out to members that you've got, I think most of this has been gone through in terms of questions and answers, but you do have a memo from Finance on Lease Purchase for Technology, questions and answers. So, quick one.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick thing. When I hear about some of these documents and some of these things, even though one person may make a request, everybody kind of has an interest. So any documents that have been sent on the subject to anybody whatsoever on the committee, on any subject, please make sure to get to everybody and anything in the future, because
better if they're electronic links.
Especially electronic.
Want to download them, can download them.
Extra cost to just copy everybody, those who maybe can't or won't, but we understand. It'd be good. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments or questions or suggestions?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to testify. The last slide, really, I think we've sort of touched upon already, and hope that this was helpful.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, meeting adjourned.